Hi, and welcome to the My Dog Made Me Do It Naturally podcast. I am your host, Kat Jepsen, a canine nutritionist with an innate obsession with dogs and the natural ways in which we are driven to live because of them. So, let's get to it.
Good morning and welcome back to another episode of the My Dog Made Me Do It Naturally podcast. This morning I am joined by a very, very special guest who has been so influential on my own journey into holistic pet health in general and who is an absolute favourite of mine. So I am very, very grateful to be able to speak with her today. This morning's guest is Dr. Lise Hansen. Good morning, Dr. Lise.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Okay, so for anyone who doesn't know, which I'm guessing most of you do, Dr. Lise Hansen, otherwise known as the Alternative Vet, decided to be a vet at 12 years old and has now been a veterinary surgeon for 31 years. Not long after graduating in 1994, Dr. Lise became trained in acupuncture and homeopathy and has successfully been running a homeopathic referral practice since 1998 that has been spread over three clinics in both Denmark and here, the UK. Dr. Lise published her first book. I'm hoping you might have more books coming out later on. The Complete Book of Cat and Dog Health in 2019. And throughout her entire career has been a huge advocate for encouraging informed choices and agency for pet parents, including shouting loudly for changes in the way we so easily neuter and vaccinate our pets by sharing an alternative view of how we can care for them together. As well as running a successful practice and advocating for change, Dr. Lise also speaks internationally to other veterinary surgeons and pet parents about homeopathy and other alternative methods of caring for our pets. Okay, welcome, Dr. Lise. That was
a mouthful. Intentionally and internationally, yes.
Yes, both. That's it. We'll take both.
I'll take both.
Yeah, me too. Okay, so 31 years in practice, that's impressive. That's a long time, isn't it? And have
that's
you loved
crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's good though. It's good that you've been, you've had so much time to help pets around the world. So my first question is, have you always been leaning more towards the holistic approach, or was it something that came after you had qualified and practiced for a while? And if so, what was the turning point for you that inspired this path?
I wasn't conscious of it, and if you'd spoken to me as a vet student, I think I would have been quite rude about it. It was just not on my radar at all. I saw myself as a scientist, and of course I know now that science is not the opposite of a holistic at all, on the contrary, but it just wasn't my world. I think my story is quite typical, and I think what happens for so many of us is that two things that coincide, I suppose. When you train in medicine, and I don't really think it's the same thing, I'm sure, whether you train in human medicine or in veterinary medicine, but you have this idea that you're going to go out and cure. You become a vet obviously because you love animals and you want to help them and you want to cure them when they're ill, make their lives better. And I don't think anyone ever said as much to me, but it was my very clear understanding that sick animals were going to come to me, and I was going to, through this clever detective work out what was wrong with them, and then I was going to treat them, and then they would be well. And what happens, and I think it happens to everybody, if I'm honest, is that you go into practice with this assumption, and then you find out, and I think it takes 3 to 5 years to find out that they don't really get well. It's very, very few patients that come to you really ill, and you save them, and they walk away into the sunset and they're cured, and you don't see them again because they're well now. What happens in practice today, human practice and veterinary practice, is the management of chronic disease. There are some situations, accidents, surgeries, there are some situations where you can go in quite dramatically and cure something and the problem is solved and it doesn't come back. But most of the things that are being treated by doctors or vets are chronic diseases that are not curable with the toolkit available to us. So it's the same patient coming back with the same problem year in, year out. If you've got an allergic dog or an asthmatic cat or whatever it is, it's their problem, and they come to you for treatment next year and the year after, and eventually they come for treatment of the side effects of the first treatment that you gave them as well. So it's a heavy thing to realize that they're actually not getting cured. You're maybe easing to a certain extent in the short term, but really you're just managing something chronic that's getting worse and worse, and the medicines that you're giving are adding to that. So I think there is an element of becoming quite disillusioned within the first few years in practice that I think hits everybody. And then it's how you deal with that. You know, some people sort of think, well, yeah, well, I was young and they even thought I was going to save the world and now I'm going to play golf and make money. Or, you know, it depends how you deal with it. But there is a crisis that happens after a couple of years in practice. And for me, it coincided with, I was quite severely ill with preeclampsia during my first pregnancy, and was going to be induced very, very early, and was fighting against that, and, you know, organs setting out and doctors saying this is not an option. And in desperation went to see a homeopath, and the problem just from one day to the next was gone, to the point where the doctor's saying, well, the lab must have been wrong. And that's really interesting, because they did bloods 3 times a week for, you know, at least a month, and all those lab results were clearly wrong. But I remember the doctor sitting there saying, well, that can't happen. So clearly someone was wrong somewhere along the way, because what just happened to you can't happen. Yeah. So I thought, maybe I'll look at this a bit more then, because I was, you know, I mean, my life was at risk and the baby's life was at risk, and 3 days later we're both fine.
Wow!
And I think that happens to most of the vets and doctors that I've met who work holistically have had that combination of feeling quite disillusioned with the tools they've acquired at medical school, and some experience, personal or family or whatever, where you sort of think, that was weird. That was unexpected. Let's have a look at that.
Yeah.
But the excitement then, when you find a tool that can do stuff that you know is impossible, is amazing. And I have that every single day. Every single day when I drive home from work, I'm like thinking, that wasn't supposed to be able to happen. That, you know, and that just doesn't go away. So it's fantastic when you get a tool that can do so much more than what you've been taught is possible.
No, I can
see. That was a very long answer to a very short question. But
No, it's all wonderful. And I do have to agree, I think, because it is evident in the way that the world works at the minute, in terms of how people think about alternative therapies, unless you have an experience of one personally and you've seen it play out with your own eyes, it's hard for people to conceptualize and understand, isn't it? Because it's not science. You can't break it down into its components and understand it that way. So it does help to have that experience. So really, you have your first child to thank for your journey into this fabulous world of homeopathy.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful for that. I mean, I'm so grateful for that, you know. When I started learning homeopathy, my whole life changed and my whole worldview changed, and the experiences that you get through practice, it's just mind-blowing, and I'm so grateful for that. It's the most remarkable tool.
I can imagine. Oh, we might have to do another episode where we explore.
We're not supposed to be talking about that today.
Never enough time. Okay, so my next question. You published your book, which I do have a copy of it here. Let me just take out my post-it note with all my scribbles on. The complete book of cat and dog health. Oh, I don't think you can see that because it's not my face. There we go. So you published this book in 2019. Which was out just over 10 years of you doing homeopathic practice, I think. No?
More than that.
20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what inspired you to actually write the book? And was it that you noticed that pet parents were struggling with caring for their pets? Or, you know, did you always want to write a book? Or, you know, what inspired you to write it? And if you could, you could kindly just give us a little bit of a description about what the book's got in it, because it is absolutely fabulous.
Thank you. Yes, I think it was a frustration that so many of the things that we do are just clearly not helpful, you know, and I just wanted to get the word out there, having the same experience. I mean, having the same conversation several times every single day, I just thought this, I want more people to be aware. So really what I wanted to put in the book is everything that I feel, sort of the minimum database that I feel everybody must have if they care for a dog or a cat, and just put it down once and for all, so I can refer to that and explain properly, rather than try to have a sort of shortened conversation 10 times a day, really. It started out wanting to write a sort of patient manual so that I could, when I have these consultations, that I can say, you can read about this and this and this here. And then it kind of grew from there. But it's what I feel everybody who cares for a dog or a cat must know. If everybody knew that, you know, dogs and cats would be healthier. That's what I wanted to put in the book. And it ended up being kind of three books in one. The first part is lifestyle choices. Whereas the first majority of my working life, it's been mending sick patients, if you want to put it like that, you know, patching things together once they've gone wrong. It just became more and more clear to me, and that process is still happening really, that so much of what goes wrong for animals is either caused by things we do in ignorance, or could have been prevented at least if we'd done things differently or done something else. So I'm increasingly interested in looking at what we can do earlier in the process. You know, how can we prevent illness? Looking at lifestyle choices. So the first part of the book is about these decisions, these lifestyle choices that every dog or cat carer are making, even if they're not consciously considering them. We are making decisions about parasite prevention. You know, are we going to be using flea and tick products and wormers and et cetera, et cetera? We're making decisions about diet. We're making decisions about vaccination, and we're making decisions about neutering. So this is for everybody who has a completely healthy animal. These choices have to be made, and they are so crucial in how their life is going to go. So I cover those in the first part of the book, these lifestyle choices. The middle part of the book is about holistic treatments and when they are helpful, you know, when are they appropriate. So it talks about herbal medicine, acupuncture, chiropractics, osteopathy, homeopathy in an animal, what you call it, you know, how do they apply to animals? Exactly, context. Yeah. That's the word I was looking for. And you know, what sort of conditions might you want to look for an acupuncturist? What sort of health problems might you want to look for a homeopath? And also, significantly, where do you find them? So I've got lists of the various organizations of holistic vets around the world. And the third part of the book is more specific, probably something that you would use if you're caring for a sick animal. So it's just sort of tips and things I think you should know if you have a dog with epilepsy, or if you have a cat with kidney disease, or if you have a dog with an allergy. So that's more sort of probably not something you'd read from beginning to end, but something that you'd look up if you're dealing with a specific problem. So it's kind of trying, it's maybe a bit all over the place, but it's trying to do three different things. And I think increasingly I find myself talking about the first part of the book, because more and more I think it's really, really important that we think about what we do before we have a chronically ill animal. In terms of preventing disease.
Yeah, because it can be quite easily done, can't it? And it's this theory again of having the information to hand and then being able to make your choice based on having all the facts, rather than just, you know, one story from one avenue. You know, looking at the research and things. And it is a very fabulous book, and I have a feeling it was one of those things where you started writing and then you know, as you were going, you were like, oh, I need to put this in, or yes, I need to put this in, I need to put this in. And just kept going. But it is absolutely fabulous. And I got my first, my as an adult, got my first dogs in 2016. And if I would have had this book when I first got my dogs, then, you know, I think things would have been a hell of a lot different for us, for me as a pet parent, especially. So I do recommend anyone who hasn't got it, get it on the bookshelf.
and that was also the thing, because people were always saying to me when they were in the consulting room and they had a really sick animal and they'd been going to vets for years. I mean, I'm typically the person you come to when all other avenues have been exhausted and you're looking at euthanasia. You know, that's when people get desperate and they come and see someone like me. And when you're then able to turn it around and cure someone who's been ill for years, what I hear all the time is people saying, but why didn't anyone tell me? Why was I told, you know, where could I have found this information? Why don't people know this? Which is also what made me write the book, because, you know, I think these are important conversations, and it's important information that there are other ways of doing things, and there are better ways of doing things very often.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it is one of those struggles as well, particularly now, because we've got all these dogs and cats and they're all suffering from chronic diseases. And then you've got pet parents trying their best and trying loads of different things to try and help them on their own, because they're not getting anywhere with traditional methods. And they do feel backed into a corner where they feel like you're going to have no other choice but than to have the animal put to sleep. And some vets are actually kind of like endorsing this as well, because I rescued my third dog this year, and her owner was considering having her put to sleep because he couldn't cope anymore with her problems. And she's basically got recurring ear infections and itchy skin, you know, typical kind of like allergy, we call them allergies, but you know, they're not allergies. And you know, you just can't quite believe that these problems can be turned around by simple dietary changes and, you know, lifestyle recommendations, removing toxins from the environment, that this is what's happening for these pets, you know. And it's kind of like, if you do have a toolkit like this book where you've got different options to explore, then, you know, you just kind of get that confidence back, and it helps to reassure you that there is another way and that there is light at the end of the tunnel. So yeah, thank you for contributing this amazing book to our society. Okay, so one of the topics you've always been so passionate about is neutering, isn't it? So now, the first study, well, blanket recommendations for neutering dogs has been around for I don't know, how long has that even been around for? When did that?
Well, it's a really interesting topic, because I'm not sure it has been something that I've been, I think if you'd asked me 5 years ago, certainly sort of 8 to 10 years ago, it wouldn't have been big on my radar. And I think that actually goes for most vets. I mean, I can't speak for most vets, but it wasn't a topic. It wasn't something with a lot of attention. And neutering is a really interesting area once you start looking at it, because it's something that is so strongly, I mean, what people choose to do is almost entirely decided by, well, the chance. It depends on where you happen to live. You know, it's a cultural thing. Yeah. It's been the case for ages that in the States, it seems that everybody is neutered. If you own a dog, you neuter it. And very often they're neutered by the time you get your puppy at 8 weeks old. It's been neutered already. And it has been drummed into people as the way to be a responsible pet owner is to spay and neuter your dogs. It's been the sort of mantra. I did an interview with an American radio station when my book was out, and when I started talking about neutering, they just kind of couldn't talk to me. It was so challenging for them, because it's just drummed into everyone that responsible pet ownership is to spay and neuter your dogs. So in America, that's what you do, and that's what everybody does, and no one questions it, and probably no one really thinks about it. It's just the way it is. And if you live in Norway, which is kind of the opposite pole to that, it's been illegal. It is illegal to neuter dogs. It's seen as mutilation, and there's no foundation for it, and you can't do it. And if you have a male and a female dog, and you're struggling to make sure that they don't mate, maybe they're siblings, and it's difficult for you to have these two dogs in the same house, and you go to the vet, they are legally bound, they cannot neuter one of them. You will have to rehome them then. You simply can't do it unless it's for health reasons. It's seen as utterly unethical and illegal. in Sweden, it's not illegal, but it's considered unethical. And just why would you? So, yeah. I mean, Norway and Sweden, it's high 90% of dogs that are intact. And yeah. and in those countries, again, it's not really something people think about. It's just, why on earth would you want to do that? What a horrible thing to somebody. Yeah. So it's been a culturally decided decision. And I'm not even sure you can call it a decision, because it was just habit is such a strong factor. And yeah. I think it goes for several of these topics that you don't really think about it. Mm-hmm. Until you look at it and then you think, oh my God, why did I never think about this before? You know, that goes for feeding highly processed diets or vaccine. Why would a dog need we need 7 vaccines every year? I mean, the rest of us don't. So there's just these things that you think, how come it never occurred to me before? But then once you start looking at it, it's very
you
obvious.
Think, why did I never think about it?
Why did I never notice this? Why did it never occur to me? I mean, in the UK, it's sort of around 70% of dogs are neutered or were neutered. It's not that it's unusual in the UK to have an intact animal, but still most are neutered. But I think still that until very recently, for most people, it wouldn't really have been an active decision. It would just have been, this is how I keep my dogs. This is what I do. This is what I've always done. And that's the main reason for doing it, which is why I think neutering is such an interesting topic, because it's just, it's random, isn't it? It's not something that was given much thought, and it's just something that we did or didn't, depending on where we happened to be living. And then what happened in 2013, a study was published from an American university looking at lifetime health stats of 700 and something dogs. They had a population of golden retrievers where they had all their health data. So they analyzed that, looking at, you know, what factors influenced the diseases that they got and longevity, et cetera, and they found, quite shockingly, it was one of those, you know, remember where you were when, I mean, I think most vets who read that article in 2013 thought, what is going on? It showed clearly for the first time that neutered dogs, male and female, had a significantly higher risk of getting ill with cancer, osteoarthritis, and cruciate problems, knee problems, cruciate ligament problems. And yeah, if you had asked me in 2012, if I knew to my dog, what influence is it going to have on the health of his knees? Yeah. I would have said, well, unless he becomes very obese, I can't see that it would have any influence at all. And then suddenly there was this study showing that you markedly increase the risk of cruciate ligament disease, cancer, and osteoarthritis if you neuter. So, and that was sort of the starting point, because then everybody thought, what is going on here? And then it was like there was just a flurry of studies. And there was one point around sort of, I don't know, 16, 17, 18, where it seemed that every week there was a new study that someone had published comparing the risk of neutering in different breeds and different places and different in context of different diseases. And it suddenly, from being something that nobody talked about or thought about, it became a real, the spotlight was put on neutering. Yeah. And obviously it was easy to study as well, because of the geographical differences. It's easy to find a population in Norway and a population in the States and just compare them, because one will be neutered and one won't. And what that led to was sort of a decade of a feeling in the veterinary community that, okay, maybe neutering is not quite as benign a procedure as we used to think. But, you know, let's not be hasty, maybe, or there are also benefits. And I don't know, change is just slow. I think humans are just very conservative by nature, and sometimes it's really not in our own interest. But there has been a decade between that first study in 2013, just over a decade, where there's been an increasing awareness that maybe we shouldn't do it, or at least maybe it has become slightly, unfortunately, maybe we should do it later. Maybe we should postpone and not neuter very, very young puppies, but let them have their first season or whatever. But that debate has kind of landed in May, the end of May. I was going to say this year, but I can't anymore. May 2024, the World Small Animal Veterinary Association, which is a sort of umbrella organization for all the global umbrella organization for all the veterinary associations, that is a sort of leading focus for independent research and expert advice. And they published for the first time ever global veterinary guidelines about reproduction of dogs and cats. That has never been the case before. So the World Small Animal Veterinary Association put together an expert team. So these are professors from universities around the world, professors in reproduction, who have, in this report, gone through all the published research, looked at all the risk factors, and then, in conclusion, offered their advice. I was tempted to say instructions, because obviously these are the world's leading experts speaking. Saying to vets all over the world, and they say in the preface to the report, you know, we're writing this to make sure that vets everywhere kind of catch up with the latest research and give sound advice. And then they go through all the research, and then they conclude to tell vets how they should advise the dog carers and cat carers on neutering. And their advice is very, very clear that dogs are healthier if they are left intact. It's just very, very clear. So I would say there is going to be a before and after May 2024 in terms of how we keep dogs. You need a very, very clear, specific reason if you're going to neuter a dog today. And because we're in this transitional phase now, I mean, I was just looking at it with a colleague recently, that you can still go onto major veterinary clinics and look at their websites, and they haven't updated them. So there's going to be a period now where all the information that is out there is just not current. Vets should be aware, and I hear lots of people say, yeah, but my vet recommend neutering. And my response to that would be, you probably had the conversation before May 2024. And everything that we used to say and think and advise and do before May 2024 is in the past. We have these guidelines now. The information is out there now. So it's a new situation. So we just have to look at it with... It's just a different world now in terms of keeping dogs. We no longer neuter dogs. And let me just, when I say that, let me just modify. I'm talking about routine neutering of healthy dogs. Obviously, if your male dog has got testicular cancer, or if your female dog has got, you know, well, womb infection or something wrong with her that is worsened by seasons or whatever, there can be sound reasons for neutering, but I'm talking about the routine neutering for no particular reason other than that's what we used to do, or that's what I've always done, or that's probably easier or whatever. When we do that, we now know, and I started out by saying this, quoting this original study that pointed out an increased risk of cancer, arthritis, and joint problems, but subsequent studies have pointed to an increased risk of almost any condition you can think of. Neutered dogs have more thyroid disease, more allergies, more autoimmune disease, more bladder disease. I mean, they are just more sick on a fundamental level. It turns out that the sexual hormones are not just about reproduction at all. And when we remove them, we significantly reduce their level of health. So it's just not something that we can do anymore.
It's sad, isn't it, as well? Because like, even though these studies have been around for a decade and this has been happening for a decade, sometimes it seems like, you know, that these studies have been hiding under a rock, because like millions of people still don't know about the impacts of spay and neuter. And it's kind of like, even like, I get surprised at how little people know about it, because I mean, obviously being immersed in the holistic health space, you kind of, you've been hearing this for so long that you think, what, has nobody kind of caught up yet?
But I think it's also, I think part of it is that until May, it has been, some people think and some other people think and my vet says and blah, blah, blah. But that's all ended now. So I really think we can draw a line and say with the WSAVA report, May 2024, and it's not a holistic view. That's the point. It's not that holistically speaking, or it's not an alternative view. It's not a view. I mean, scientific fact is not a viewpoint. It is what it is. No vet, if there's a vet today, 2025 now, if a vet in 2025 says, well, she's, you know, Molly will be whatever, 6 months, 1 year, let's neuter her, find a different vet today, because that they are not keeping up. That's just not what we're saying now. And there is a period of, there is just a gap. I think it's just inevitable. There's a gap between scientific discovery and practical application everywhere. You know, information needs to filter out, habits need to change, everybody needs to go on that course, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But I mean, it's been more than 6 months now since the global expert recommendations came out saying just don't do this. So there's no argument for routinely neutering healthy animals today. It's an irresponsible thing to do. I thought it was quite funny, and some people misunderstood when I got into terrible trouble. The report in their concluding chapter introduces a term that I've never heard before. They say when you sit as a vet and you have to advise a dog parent about what to do with their young dog, the you don't really have to take into consideration the breed of dog or size of dog or, you know, the pros and cons of neutering, because it's not about the pros and cons of neutering. There are no pros, really. It's you can't do it. You shouldn't do it. That's clear. The thing you have to consider is, are the owners RPOs or are they not RPOs? And I thought, what the heck's an RPO? I missed something here. An RPO is a responsible pet owner. And they say the only situation where as a vet you should neuter a healthy animal is if you think that these people are just not, you know, they don't understand how to look after a dog. I can't possibly. I thought that was funny. They say if you have a responsible pet owner, tell them to keep their dog intact.
Yeah.
And obviously they need to understand that the female will come into heat twice a year and you need to keep her on a lead and you can't take her to the park and let her go. You know, your male dog may be focused on the neighbor's dog being on heat. And, you know, you need to understand the process and you need to be able to keep your dog at home. But I mean, if you can't have an intact dog, you shouldn't really have a dog at all, should you?
Yeah. Well, this is the argument as well with a lot of the things, like, you know, back in the day when things were different and we didn't have all the toxins and everything else that we do now, then it was, from here, it feels like it must have been kind of simple to look after dogs and cats back then. Obviously, I don't know, because I wasn't there. But now, you know, you have to consider their nutrition and you have to, you know, take all of these factors into account. And it's about keeping dogs separate if you've got, obviously, you've got male and female in the same house. But it's the thing, you know, having pets, being pet parents of dogs or cats is a huge, huge, huge responsibility. No less of a responsibility than having children. So, you know, if you're not willing to put this work in and do this effort, then you shouldn't really be having pets, because, you know, this is the whole part of it. And one thing I struggle to understand is why you wouldn't want to go to these lengths for your pets, because that's the whole, you know, you get so much enjoyment out of being their advocate and caring for them and providing all these beautiful things and experiences that it's part of life, isn't it? So I do think, you know, I have a house of two intact males and obviously an intact female, which is a new situation to me, so I've got, you know, I'm going to be learning how to navigate that over the next, you know, in the future because Lola's only just joined us this year. But you know, I think one of the things I did want to ask about, actually, and this is, you know, kind of a cheeky personal question, obviously females do have a risk of getting pyometra. And that is largely a concern for pet owners who have the female dogs. What kind of things do you think puts a dog more at risk of developing this kind of infection? And would that be, you know, a common reason why you would advise somebody to have a bitch spayed?
I would. It's the argument I hear the most, particularly when speaking to Americans, because it's one of the things that have been drummed into them. You know, it takes away the risk of, I mean, paramitra is an infection of the womb. And if you remove the womb, or if you remove the ovaries and take away all the hormones, then you obviously you don't get paramitra. I think the logic of removing a healthy organ so that it can't ever in the future become sick is a slightly twisted one. I mean, yeah. We should have our appendixes and I don't know, breasts and whatever else removed right now so that they can never become ill. I think it's an odd logic, yeah. But it's clearly an argument that's been used. Paramitra is a fairly common condition in intact females. It's what we call a disease with high morbidity but low mortality. So it happens quite often, but it's rarely fatal. We've become better at treating it. When I say this, someone always has a story of a childhood dog that died of paramitra 15 years ago. And of course, it can happen if your dog is ill and you don't notice and you don't go to a vet, then yes, it's a risk. But it's also a risk that is in countries where most dogs are intact, it's easily, everybody's aware of the symptoms, it's diagnosed and it's treated. These days, it is treatable with drugs. You don't necessarily have to neuter them, but sometimes you do. And it's something that can happen. I don't think in any world that it's an argument for neutering healthy animals. I just don't buy the whole argument of taking away an organ so that they can't become ill in the future. Yeah. It's particular when it happens, the thing to look out for, and it's part of this being an RPO, I suppose. I mean, I think we need t-shirts and badges, and you know, I like the whole RPO. I've never heard that term before. But if you are a responsible pet owner and you have an intact female, obviously you need to be aware that she'll come into heat roughly twice a year, and for that period, most of that period at least, she'll need to be kept away from males. Mm-hmm. Most female dogs then have a period, a month or two after the heat, where they are dominated by progesterone, so they're feeling slightly kind of they feel more, they want to be nesting, they may not be quite so energetic or extrovert or active, they get more, maybe get more cuddly. I mean it's my impression that young women are much more aware of their hormonal cycles than we were in my day and age, and it's a bit similar to that, just an awareness of she's in a progesterone phase, you know, she's in a autumn or winter phase or whatever it's called these days, you know, so she, it's kind of, it's sofa and Netflix and chocolate time, it's not necessarily let's go man trailing. But a lot of people think she's ill because she seems subdued, she seems quiet, she seems different, and she's not ill. She's just under the influence of different hormones. Being a female is never like that. Being a female with a natural cycle means that you feel different at different times. So I think part of what we need is respect, maybe it's the wrong word, but just more of an understanding of that natural cycle. And the fact that a female dog will feel slightly differently when she's in a estrogen phase, which is the just before the heat and the heat, and the progesterone phase, which is after the heat, than the part that what we call anestrus, where the hormones are quiet in between two heats. So she will be different, but that's what it means to be an intact natural female. So I think a greater understanding for that is part of what we need. A bit more respect for nature, really. If I can go that far. Yeah, exactly. And being a female is different from being a male, and you're not supposed to be the same every day. You are affected by where you are in your cycle, and so are our dogs when we let them be full, healthy individuals. And you were asking about pyometra, sorry. And the what I was going to say is the high risk of pyometra is in that progesterone dominated phase after the season for up to 2 months, really. So if, and at that, during that phase, just keep an eye on her. You know, is she eating? Is she drinking? And the main symptom is a discharge from the vulva. So if she has a discharge from the vulva when she's not in heat, she needs to go see a vet. Mm-hmm. That's really all it takes to be an RPO in terms of pyometra. If there's a discharge from a female dog and she's not in heat, take her to a vet.
Yeah. So again, it's all about being in tune with your pets and observing your pets and really knowing, you know, getting to know your pets on a level where you can tell when they're a little bit, you know, different in terms of when you follow the cycles, this is not part of her usual difference, you know, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Which I think people do tend to struggle with that because, you know, I feel like connection is something that's missing in a lot of people's lives.
But it's kind of the win-win when you start to become more informed, isn't it?
Yeah.
That you notice more and you understand each other better. Yeah. And it just enforces the bond.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, thank you for that. So I think in the cases where it may be the safest option to neuter our pets, whether it's if it's due to, I don't know, situations or disease or anything like that, what are the other options that we can explore, obviously, to kind of to nurture the hormones the best that we can?
That's a really good question. And there are some important things to be said about that. I'm slightly worried about, because obviously this is what vets are talking about at the moment, is that especially, in America and in countries where neutering has been the norm, this realization suddenly that, you know, we can't do that anymore. What's going to happen? How are we going to handle this new situation? And I find that American vets often have turned it into, not we can't neuter anymore, because it just seems to be too big of a mouthful, even though it's what the science is telling us. The message is very clear. What American vets, to a large extent, in it seems to me, are saying is, well, let's take a step in the right direction and neuter later. And they talk about, you know, we mustn't early neutering, the detrimental effect of early neutering. And every time I see that, the detrimental effect of early neutering, it just, oh, it frustrates me, because no, it's not the detrimental effect of early neutering. It's the detrimental effect of neutering at all. We really shouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. Neutering, and there are some confusions about the procedures, really. Neutering means taking away the sexual hormones, and that is done by taking away the ovaries. Mm-hmm. When I was at vet school and we learned how to neuter dogs, we took away the uterus and the ovaries. So we took away everything. Okay. More modern techniques now in most places mean that we just take away the ovaries, because when you take away the ovaries, you're removing the hormones, and the uterus just doesn't do anything at all. You don't get pyometra either, for instance. The uterus is still there, but because there's no hormonal influence, it's just completely inactive as an organ. It doesn't do anything. And when you only take away the advantage to only taking away the ovaries is that it's a smaller bit of surgery, so you can do keyhole surgery to do it. So rather than, you know, opening your dog up in the midline all the way down, you can just do a small flank incision and take away the ovaries. But both of those bits of surgery, whether you're removing just the ovaries or the ovaries and the womb, both of those bits of surgery are a full spay. They're a full neuter, because you take away the ovaries, you take away the hormones. Mm-hmm. And I hear a lot of people say, I would never go for a full spay. I'm only going to have, you know, the keyhole surgery. And that's nonsense, because if you take away the ovaries, your dog is spayed. And the issue when you neuter is you're taking away the hormones. And that's what leads to all these dangerous health effects. So anything that takes away the ovaries is a neutered dog. There are some newer surgeries that are being suggested as a sort of halfway house. And again, I think it's mostly relevant to the Americans, because having intact dogs can be so fear-inducing, apparently, to them. I mean, Norwegians would just scratch their necks and think, well, what? Why? But a halfway first step can be that you reverse, that you still operate, but you leave the ovaries in place and remove the uterus. You have a hormonally fully intact dog then. She'll still come into heat. They won't be quite as noticeable, but she will feel it the same. She will have the completely normal hormonal changes. So she will still be an intact dog hormonally, but she will be sterile because she doesn't have a uterus. She can't become pregnant, and she obviously can't get an infected uterus because she doesn't have one. But so it's a way of, if you're living in fear of pyometra and you are worried that you can't stop her becoming pregnant, it's a way to have an intact dog but remove those issues. It's a big piece of surgery. It's actually a bigger operation than a normal spay because you still have the hormones. It's really, really important that you remove all of the uterus so you can't get what we call a stump pyometra in any remaining uterine tissue. So mm-hmm. It's a bigger incision and it's a bigger piece of surgery than a normal spay would be, where you're not too worried if you leave behind a bit of the uterus because you're taking away the ovaries, so there's not going to be any hormonal influence. So it's a bigger piece of surgery, and personally I can't really see what you gain from it. It's mm-hmm. not safe to have what we call this an ovary sparing spay or an OSS, where you have the hormonally intact dog, but she doesn't have a womb. You can't really let her run around and mate at will anyway. I mean, that's just not safe.
Yeah.
Dogs will fight and, you know, you can't just take her to the park and let her run around. She's still going to attract males. She's still going to want to stand. And I mean, that sounds highly unsafe to me. And as I said before, I don't really buy the argument of removing large organs just so that they can never become ill. That seems a bit twisted in my mind. But it's certainly better if you have a dog. Maybe the situations, and actually the WSAVA report suggests this, in situations where you must neuter, which I think was your question, it can be a solution because clearly she's sterile, but she's still hormonally intact. So for instance, if you get a dog from a rescue center, or if you've signed a contract with the breeder that they won't let you have an intact dog, or whatever situation where you need to have a dog that is sterile, but you're worried about, as you should be, neutering, then an ovary-sparing spay can be a solution for those situations for females. And for males, you can just do a vasectomy, the same as men often do if they don't want children or don't want any more children. Hormonally intact, sexually active, but shooting blanks. So you can do the same for dogs. It's a simple operation, but it doesn't solve the fact that you just can't let him stray, and that he's still going to want to go out looking for females in heat. So it means if they do mate, they're not gonna. There won't be any puppies. But it's not a, you know,
it's not nice to just let them do what they want.
No, see, exactly.
This is one of the things which frustrates me about this. Well, it's not even just with neutering; it's about everything else. It's because it feels like everybody's just searching for the most convenient way to care for a pet, which, you know, everybody wants to go down the neutering route so they don't have to be on their toes about when their bitch is in season, or, you know, their male dog's showing interest in a female dog, because it's too much trouble when that situation comes around. Because, and I think it's largely a lot to do with the mindset that society has around, you know, everybody just wants convenience because they're all stressed out, they're all tired, lives are busy.
I think a lot of it is just habit.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's just getting used to new ways of doing things. That transition is always really difficult. And then, you know, I mean, in 5 years, they're not going to, certainly in 10 years, there aren't going to be any neuter dogs around. Not unless they had a serious health issue. You know, it's going to be intact dogs. And we're going to think, why did we think that was a problem? You know, what was the big deal? So it's just that change. And I think another important thing to say when we're talking about this is that I have a lot of conversations at the moment with dog carers and colleagues who are quite stunned and shocked by this new information, because I mean, if you've become a vet because you want to help animals and you've been in practice for 30 years like I have, I mean, most vets in conventional practice will probably neuter a dog a day. So you're suddenly looking at having caused a lot of harm. If you if you've devoted your professional life to helping animals and you have to look back and think, did I do more harm than good just out of ignorance? That's a very difficult situation. Yeah. And I think it's also why a lot of us, I find when I would talk about this, not so much now, because now the verdict is in. I mean, now there is no doubt, there is no debate. We cannot safely neuter anymore. But a year ago, when it was still, there is increasing evidence that this is not safe, but it was still sort of, how do we deal with this new evidence? A lot of people intuitively reject it.
Yeah,
that can't be right. You know, I don't think so. And I think that comes from a vulnerable place of, I can't bear it if that's right, because I've neutered dogs and maybe some of those dogs really suffered with arthritis or died from cancer. And realizing now that that probably wouldn't have happened if we hadn't neutered them is a very difficult situation to be in. And I think we just must say very, very clearly that we cannot blame ourselves for decisions that we made before the information was available. I mean, we didn't know. We just didn't know. And we did the best we could with the knowledge that was available to us. But today it's a very different situation, and we cannot watch while puppies are neutered or dogs are neutered for no particular reason other than ignorance. Ah, you're back.
Oh, you can always rely on technology. It kicked me out. It's such an important part as well. Yeah, so we'll dive straight back in because it's still recording. So you were saying that it's a hard pill to swallow, basically, if you then realize that you could have contributed to this, you know, pain. So have you been in that situation then? How do you deal with that?
Well, I'm having this conversation all the time at the moment, and I think it's really, really important that we forgive ourselves and each other. I mean, it just makes no sense. Yes, maybe you had the dog of your life that died of cancer 10 years ago, having been neutered for no particular reason, and now you realize that I might have caused that. You know, they might have lived a full life if they hadn't been neutered, but the information wasn't available, and it just we have to forgive ourselves. We act on the information that is available to us, and it's the best we can do. But the flip side of that is that now that the information is available, I find it very difficult to know that there probably are still dogs being neutered for no particular reason other than habit and ignorance. And the information has actually been very clearly available now for more than 6 months. And I think that's what I can't bear to think of. And that's why we're having this conversation on a Saturday morning, isn't it? Because everybody, and I really think everybody who, I was going to say everybody who has a dog, but no more than that, everybody who is interested in dog health need to talk about this. You know, talk about it everywhere. Talk about it in parks and wherever you go and whoever you know. We no longer routinely neuter dogs. It's not an alternative view. It's not a holistic view. It's what the world's leading experts are saying to vets all over the world. Unless there is a particular reason why that particular dog needs to be neutered, it's no longer something that we can do because it's dangerous and it's harmful. And we must get that information everywhere as quickly as possible. We can't do anything about the mistakes of the past, but we can make sure that they're not repeated now, that everybody really should know better.
Yeah, because it's not just about, like, it's not just about, you know, you have your dog neutered at whatever age, a young age, whenever, and then later on they'll get a debilitating disease. These dogs are suffering all their lives, aren't they, with various different problems, and some of them, like their muscular development is impacted by it, and then you've got obviously problems with allergies and the immune system, because the hormones are still, you know, the hormone systems are all interconnected throughout the body and they're all sending messages to each other, but there's nobody home in the reproductive section. Exactly. So then they're going somewhere else and causing problems in other aspects of the body. So it's not like it's you have it done once and then later on they're going to get a disease and maybe die younger than they were supposed to, or they could have otherwise done so. It's the fact that they will have problems more than likely throughout the whole of their life, isn't it?
It is both that you have them neutered and then at some point they get debilitating arthritis or they get cancer, but there's also a lot of behavioral issues that are directly caused by neutering. What seems to be the mechanism behind it is the fact that there's this feedback system between the sex organs, the testicles in the male and the ovaries in the female, that produce the primary sexual hormones, and the brain. And the brain, the pituitary gland, releases hormones, particularly the hormone LH, luteinizing hormone, in a feedback loop with the sexual organs. So that's how the levels of sex hormones is maintained, that there's this feedback loop. And then we then surgically neuter a dog and take away one half of that loop. The brain keeps releasing more and more and more and more LH, because why are the sex organs not responding? You know, why doesn't this lead to the release of testosterone or estrogen or progesterone? And it doesn't, because we've cut those organs out. But what that means is that neutered animals have crazy high LH levels always. From the time we do to them and we break that loop, the levels in their body of luteinizing hormone is higher than it would ever be in a healthy, intact dog. And it turns out that LH does not only affect the sex organs and induce the production of sex hormones. There are actually LH receptors all over the body, also in the brain, and also in the areas of the brain that have to do with fear and aggression. And these very, very unnatural high levels of LH that will be present forever after, for the rest of that dog's life from the point of neutering, will have all these effects that we're only now beginning to see. And certainly behavioral problems is a big one. But also just, I hear people say, I always neutered my dogs and it's never done them any harm. But if they had animals with chronic ear problems, or, I mean, the list of health issues, apart from behavioral issues, is miles long. We just didn't know that was the connection.
So
now we do. That's the difference.
They could have had dogs that have had health problems, but they wouldn't have associated it with them being neutered. And it's ironic, isn't it, because a lot of people will say, you know, well, I'm having my male dog neutered because, you know, he's reactive, and then actually it could turn out that, you know, that's going to make the situation a whole
much
lot worse,
more likely.
But this is another thing as well. Another topic I find particularly useful to discuss is the relationship with our vets. Now, you do mention this in your book as well, which I absolutely love, because I don't think it's talked about often enough. And I think it's an area where people feel unsupported. I often find that pet parents are reluctant to challenge the advice of their vets. And rightly so, in a way, because they're highly educated. And, you know, vets obviously do that job because they care for the welfare of animals. But obviously, as we have discovered, like with neutering and sometimes with vaccines as well, that sometimes it can be detrimental when making choices for pets. And even just when, you know, if your personal view disaligns with that of your vet, could be to do with breeding or anything like that. And if they're not up to date with recent changes, which is, another thing, like as a vet, you have a responsibility to stay up to date with the most recent science, especially with the welfare of pets. So if you're not kind of jumping on the bandwagon, then, you know, you need to look at the evidence a bit more. But so what for you should pet parents be seeking from the relationship with their vet? And do you have any suggestions for what they can do if they're having a difficult time having these conversations?
I think I'm so pleased that you ask this question. I think this is a question that I don't often get. And I think it's such a key question, really, because in a lot of conversations, it turns into kind of a trench war, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And there's a them and us situation. And it's really not the case. Vets are the most hardworking, dedicated people I know. Vets, yeah. And it's a profession under enormous pressure. I mean, vets are stressed out of their minds. I don't know if you've seen on social media, there's the, what is it? NOMV is a sort of little thing on lots of social media profiles. Not one more vet. Vets have the highest suicide rates of any profession. Yeah. I mean, it is the most stressed out profession. It is, I think, by nature of the job, because you have really, really dedicated people doing a really, really difficult job. But also the way the profession is going, big corporate companies taking over more and more clinics, less freedom in what you say to people, how you do your job. You know, it's a very, very pressured situation. So even before we go into this topic properly, I would say to everybody, just please be nice to your vet. You know, I mean, if they seem stressed and rushed and I mean, maybe they don't want a hug, but they need one, you know. I mean, it's a very difficult job, and the people who are doing it are doing it for the best reasons, and they're really very often caught in a very, very difficult place. The other thing, there is a lot of vet bashing out there, and I think it's just not helpful at all. And I hear a lot of people who say, you know, my vet so-and-so, and my vet is horrible, and my vet is putting pressure. And I'm thinking, but why are they your vet? You know, I would really encourage everybody to take responsibility for finding your vet. And I think if you just turn up at the nearest practice, or the practice with the best opening hours, or the best parking, or whatever, then you almost deserve what you get. I mean, this is something that I think needs some attention. You know, who find the right vet for you and develop a relationship with them, because then they can be your best partner in looking after your animal for the whole of their life. And obviously, I mean, I think everybody deserves a good GP, but I would almost say, I think it's more important who your vet is than who your own doctor is, because because animals just, you know, you're going to need them. Even if you have a healthy, you're going to need them in terms of lifestyle choices and health checks. I mean, an animal can't say where it hurts. You know, your vet is a really helpful partner in looking after them, making sure, helping you check that you're not missing anything, but also, you know, in 10 years or so they will be very old, and you're going to need some support and some help. And if you have spent some of that time cultivating a relationship so that they know you and they know your animal and you know them, then it can be such a valuable relationship. So I think finding the right person is crucial. And most of us, if you live in the Australian outback, fair enough, but most of us have access to more than one veterinary clinic. You know, I mean, look at the vet clinics you can get to within a 45-minute drive, say, and then speak to them. And I think the puppy vaccines are a really nice opportunity to, if you go to a vet, bring questions. You know, how do you feel about neutering? How do you feel about what vaccines do you recommend? What do you think about diet? I'm considering not feeding dry food, for instance, or do you do titer testing? Or, I mean, I suggest some of these in my book. You know, there are questions you can ask to get a feel for where your vet is. Partly, what do they recommend? But also, even if it's not their general recommendation, are they open to you doing things your way? And do they listen? You know, does it feel like someone that could be on your side and that could be helpful to you? Are they respectful and are they open? And if they're not, then use the opportunity 4 weeks later, when you're having your second puppy vaccines, go to a different clinic and have another conversation. So that you find someone and then talk to them about how you like to do things. And for instance, if you bring in your animal with an issue, make it clear to them that you're not necessarily expecting them to do anything. You just want to hear their opinion. You just want to hear, is it safe that we leave this be for now? What do you think? That relationship can be so valuable and benefit the animal so much if everybody's working together in a respectful way. And I do think that the informed pet carer will really benefit from putting some attention into finding that vet, the vet that's right for you and the vet that listens to you. Something as simple as when you book an appointment, book it with a named vet. Don't just call up and book an appointment that at a time that suits you. If there are 5 or 10, whatever, however big the clinic is, if there are several vets there, make sure you get to see the same person. Insist on seeing the same person unless there's some very acute thing that needs attention. I think that's really, really worthwhile, and it will just save everyone a lot of stress. If you just go to the nearest person and it almost feels like you get, you know, I mean, I've heard people feel like they have to kind of, you know, take a deep breath and go in there and try to be strong and try to say no. And I mean, that's just, no one benefits from that sort of situation. It's stressful to the owner, it's stressful to the vet, it's stressful to the animal. It has to be cooperation. And if it isn't, then go somewhere else.
Yeah, I agree. I think as well, and it's a big fat shame, really, because like everybody's stronger as a unit, aren't they? And it's not like you can, like you say, it's not like you can live without them. And it's just sad that that pet parents even feel that way about this kind of connection. But again, it's like you say, I think having just being open to having these conversations and doing so in a, you know, a non-confrontational way, can have a conversation as an adult about two opposing views without kind of, you know, loggerheading about it.
And if you can't, then you're in the wrong place. I mean, who's not prepared to listen to you and not prepared to consider your views and not prepared to elaborate on theirs in a respectful and friendly manner, they've got no business being your vet. You know, I mean, everybody deserves better. So why would you go back to a place where you don't feel listened to and don't feel met? It just doesn't make sense. But to keep going back to the same place and then moan about them also seems a bit strange to me. You know, I think it's up to each individual pet parent to become informed, because if you just go to the, because the other side, the other way that I see sometimes is people who just go to the local vet, do whatever they say, don't question it, don't look into things. And I think, really, is that how you want to look after your own health, your children's health, your pet's health?
I think that's the majority of the population in England anyway. I think that's how people roll over here.
I don't know. I mean, I suppose I see the segment that are different from that, because I find a lot of pet owners, particularly in the UK, enormously well-informed and well-read.
Nowadays, it's becoming more widespread. There's more of a desire to explore those avenues and be that way. But sometimes you can have a well-informed pet parent who goes to the vets with every intention to stand up for their pet and kind of advocate, but then at the last minute kind of like chickens out because they don't want to deal with that confrontation. And that's where the problem is, because people don't like having difficult conversations.
No, but nor should they have to.
I think
in that situation, my best advice would be there never has to be pressure. If you feel like you came with one agenda and now you're being pushed into another, what I would always encourage anyone to say in that situation, I mean, there are very, very few life and death urgent situations that I can think of. 99.9% of the situations, it will be completely safe to say, thank you for your input. I'm just going to go home and think about it. You can always do that. And so maybe you're paying for a consultation that, you know, doesn't lead to any treatment. Fair enough. You've met them. You heard what they had to say. You're going to go home and think about it. And then go home and think about it. Don't feel pressurized. It's your responsibility, and you can see someone else. You can call the 5 nearest clinics the next day and say, I'd like to speak to someone about this issue. It's on you to find the help that you need to a certain extent. I really think it is. The other thing I often hear people say is, oh, but there's no holistic vet near me. I want a holistic vet and there's no holistic vet near me. And I think that's the wrong way of looking at it, to my mind, because being a conventional vet is a very, very strong skill set. And it is not possible for one person to be an accomplished conventional vet, you know, surgeon, internal medicine, and also be a nutritional expert, a homeopath, an acupuncturist, an osteopath. I do know colleagues who try to do everything, who are in conventional practice, but they also learn five different holistic modalities. And I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm being a bit rude now. There probably is place for a jack of all trades approach, but yeah. at least you need to be prepared then to refer when the situation demands it. Yeah. Nobody can be an expert at everything, and yeah. being a conventional vet is a difficult job, and it's an important job, and the biggest part of that job, apart from well surgery, is to diagnose disease and to yeah. keep up with all the things that happen in medicine and all the developments that happen. You know, staying ahead of that is a full-time job for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a skill set that we need. So your conventional vet, I think nobody needs a holistic vet down the road. Nobody needs a holistic vet down the road. What you need is a very competent conventional vet that you have a good rapport with.
Yeah.
They can help you diagnose problems. And then they can, once the problem is diagnosed, if it's not a surgical one, then they can help you, if it's not an acute, easy fix, to decide, well, am I going to refer you to a homeopath? And am I going to refer you to an acupuncturist? Am I going to send you to an osteopath? But the first port of call is a competent conventional vet, not a holistic vet. Someone yeah. to diagnose, someone to treat if it's acute or surgical, and otherwise help you find out where do we go from here. And lots of vets do that. I know lots and lots of my patients are referred from conventional colleagues thinking, this is an allergic dog. This is never going to get well in conventional care. I'm going to give you some eardrops, go and see a homeopath or whatever. And that's medicine when it works. That's excellent.
Yeah. So,
and if you have a holistic vet down the road, there is no way they are going to be up on the latest surgical treatments of whatever or the best test for diagnosing some, you know, I mean, you cannot be an expert at everything. So it's knowing who to see in each instance. So I really yeah. think what everybody needs down the road, or at least, some, you know, within an hour's drive, is a very highly competent conventional vet with an open, friendly attitude yeah. who can embrace people feeding differently, vaccinating differently, doing whatever. And then if you have a specific chronic problem, if you have a dog with epilepsy or IBD or allergies or whatever it may be, then you go and see a holistic practitioner for help with that issue. But your conventional GP vet doesn't have to be more than an open, pleasant person who's very competent at what they do. So yeah, it's not a conflict in my mind at all. It's not a conflict between conventional vets and holistic vets. And it's not my experience in everyday life that it's a conflict. It's just different tools that are appropriate in different situations. And to go to one person and expect something else than what they're actually offering is just a bit, it's not very productive.
Well, it's this whole concept again, isn't it? That even if you've got a good relationship with your conventional vet and they don't kind of endorse your way of life or your views or your feeding style, but they obviously respect your decisions yeah. to do things your way, it's important that you have them there to lean on so that you can, if something does go wrong, you can get the official medical diagnosis and information about what's biologically, physiologically, you know, hormonally going wrong with your pet. And then if you have awareness about other, you know, holistic therapies and different avenues, you can then obviously explore options once you've got the information. It's not saying that you have to just, you know, go 100% conventional or go 100% holistic, because I mean holistic is, it's conventional is included within the holistic space, isn't it? It's not like not like the holistic space excludes conventional practice, which is, I mean, we're massively going off topic here, but
I think it's a really interesting point, though, and because look, what I think lots of people are hoping for is if their conventional vet was also a fantastic homeopath, say, but I don't know any really qualified holistic practitioners, doctors or vets, who want to stay in conventional practice. I mean, conventional practice is a lot of, well, it has been a lot of minor surgeries. I don't want to spend my time, even years ago when it was what was done all day long. I mean, I know it's going to be different in the future, but castrating dogs, spaying dogs, vaccinating dogs, treating acute infections. I want to spend my time practicing homeopathy, because that's the only way I can become an excellent homeopath. And then, if you take it to a higher level, if you're an expert acupuncturist or an expert osteopath, you're not going to want to. I mean, you're not going to become that if you spend the bigger part of your day doing normal first opinion surgery for acute ailments. It's just not physically possible. So it's never going to happen that you're going to have a fantastic homeopath down the road who will, you know, inspect the dog that's been laying since yesterday or whatever. Because if that's how they spend their day, they're not going to reach those levels of expertise. So the situation will have to be that you have a first port of call, which is your GP vet, and then you go from there to seek out the specialist help that you need.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so that brings us back to forming that relationship so you feel comfortable in doing so as well, because I speak to pet parents who are so reluctant to take their pets to the vet because they've had a bad experience, or they've not got a very good relationship, and then, you know, that then puts the animals at risk of not receiving adequate care that they need, you know, if something's gone wrong, which, you know, if there's something wrong with your pet, then you absolutely should go and get some advice on
well, no, this is the reason why I think this is such a good point also is because I hear this every day. I'm in a referral practice where I treat animals for chronic problems. All of my patients have different vets, and I had this experience yesterday in clinic with someone who has an allergic dog. And she's been going back to the same vet, a rather rude person, for years, whenever her dog had a flare-up, typically of ear infections or hot spots or eczema on the body. And the vet is rude to her and puts a lot of pressure on her to put the dog on a daily dose of heavy immunosuppressive medications, and she doesn't want to do that. She wants to try and do it with, well, she has been trying to do it with, you know, shampoos and treating flare-ups as they happen, and now she's working with me to try and cure the animal through homeopathy. But the point is that I encouraged her to find a different vet, because it was very clear that it was really stressful to her every time she had to take a dog to the vet, which meant that sometimes she would neglect getting ear infections treated because she couldn't face it. Having to just get the eardrops and not go for the whole allergy, you know. Yeah. So she went to a different vet who took a swab from the ear, treated the ear with excellent, excellent conventional care, sent her on her way, say hello to the homeopath. You know, this will be great to see whether we can cure this thing at a deeper level. And she was nearly in tears from the relief, and that's the point I'm trying to get to, of having had a conventional vet visit that didn't feel almost abusive. And I don't understand why anyone would go back. So it's also just about empowering pet parents to get the service that they deserve. And the first port of call is a competent, friendly, communicative vet. Always. Yep. But if they're not that, then they're not your vet, obviously. Why would you go back? They don't have to be a homeopath. They don't have to understand all that, but they just have to be polite. And they have to be good at what they do, which is also possible, which is also important. I mean, this symptomatic, conventional, short-term treatment, I call it firefighting in my book, is also a part of caring for someone. You can't just say, no, you're going to suffer with this ear infection because I want only holistic treatments. I mean, that's poor care, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what we need to do is broaden the term RPO. Or let's call
great
it
term, isn't it?
RPP, responsible pet parent, because I don't like the term owner.
I know.
I don't think you do either, do you?
No.
So we should broaden that term, and we should include these other things. You know, building relationships with the people in your toolkit basically is opening up your toolkit and leaning on the people and communicating and effectively and everything like that, and then that will help us be better pet parents as well, because we'll feel more confident, more at ease. You know, we can explore things that we don't understand with the people that are educated enough to give us the answers, rather than relying on Mr. Google, because a lot of people do that, and that's where problems, you know, in themselves can happen. But no, that's fantastic. So my last question, I think we've been going for about an hour and a half already.
Sorry.
Away. No, it's absolutely fine. As a practicing alternative veterinarian for 31 years, what would be the one piece of advice you would give to any pet parent on how to care for their pets?
Ooh, it's difficult to boil it down to one,
yes, I know.
I think that the number one would be to just take it upon yourselves to be an informed pet parent. Just don't just go to the local vet and do whatever they say. Educate yourselves, because there's so much to be gained from that. It's just a win-win situation. The more you know, the better you are at asking for what you need, and the more positive the whole experience and the less frustration all around, yeah. Really. So just embrace this opportunity to learn and learn about dog health on your own. Ask questions. That would be the main one. And if I can have a second one, it would be to just be aware that there are very often, if there's a chronic issue, there are very often treatment options that your vet may not be aware of. You know, acupuncture if you've got a dog with arthritis, or osteopathy if you've got a dog with arthritis, homeopathy for anything with the immune system. There are often other treatment options. So that was basically part one and two of my book, wasn't it? I mean, inform yourself, yes, on the lifestyle choices. Don't just act, yep, by reflex. Don't just do what you've always done, but read about it. How should I vaccinate? Should I neuter? The answer is no. How should I feed? What about parasites? Just look into these topics. They are fascinating. And there has never been a more exciting time. That's the thing as well. Like, yeah, I've been a vet for more than 30 years, but the last decade for sure, even shorter than that, so much new information is becoming available on the benefits of feeding food that isn't overly processed, better vaccine practices, not to neuter. You know, all of this is stuff that wasn't really available a decade ago, for sure. It's a really, really exciting time to be interested in dog care and dog health. But it also just means for all of us, vets and breeders and dog pet parents, that we can't just instinctively, by reflex, do what we've always done, because it's just inappropriate now. We know better now.
Yeah, and it's constantly changing and evolving, isn't it?
And yeah, yeah, and it's so exciting.
It is. And if it's if like me, it will lead you down a path into enhancing your own,
yeah,
health, because that's what it's massively done for me. It's changed my whole life, is learning. And that's just from coming to learning how to help my dogs. It's helped me help my family as well. You know, it's, yeah, just so amazing. Yeah.
No, it really is a win-win situations when you start to take, you know, when we take on a dog or a cat, we take responsibility for an adult being. You know, they can't decide for themselves. So we take, yeah, on responsibility for their health. And there really is an obligation, I feel, that comes with that, that we do it in an excellent way and in a well-informed way. And we take that, absolutely, responsibility seriously. But once we start, yeah, doing that, it becomes really, really, it's just interesting. And it's just a win-win, yeah, situation. And you do learn about health, like you said. Yeah.
And you'll find yourself falling down loads of little rabbit holes.
Oh, yeah. And meeting lots of interesting people along the way.
Yeah, which is fabulous. Though. The community yeah, is absolutely amazing. It's so inspiring. And that is where you'll find your confidence as well, is relating, you know, sharing your stories, hearing other people's stories, and just connecting with like-minded people. That is, you know, that's going to be what helps you get through this whole mess of chronic disease.
Yeah. And all these situations where something seemed hopeless, and then, mm-hmm, it is resolved after all, when you get the right treatment, tools in place. That's, yeah, that's just really, really exciting. But the one thing to end on maybe is the one thing that I would just encourage everybody to do right now is tell everybody you meet that we no longer neuter dogs. Because that's yeah, gonna mean that there's a puppy somewhere or a dog somewhere that was due to be neutered, and we, yeah, and it gets to them, and that saves lives.
Yeah.
So that's what we can all do.
Saved on my phone to the guidelines to the WSAVA. I'm, yeah, like, send it.
Yeah.
Because sometimes people don't just like to hear it. They like to see with their own eyes as well,
yeah,
don't they?
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
So I'll like reinforce it. So yeah. So
and it's a very easy conversation to have because the expert advice is there. Exactly. It's not like, but my vet has a different opinion. No, it's not opinion, it's fact. Either you've heard it or you haven't heard it. It's not a debate. It's not on one hand and on the other hand. This is what we've now become aware of, and therefore it's no longer safe to neuter as a matter of routine. And here's the link that shows it.
That shows it, absolutely. Well, that was fantastic. I really loved having this conversation with you, and I hope a lot of the listeners have learned a lot from your expertise and your what you've shared with us in this session. So thank you ever so much for agreeing to be a guest on my show.
Thank you for inviting me. It was great meeting you.
Absolutely. We probably will have to maybe book in a couple more episodes to explore some of the topics we nearly kind of ventured off onto today. Because it's so easily done, isn't it?
Try to keep me on track. It's not simple.
Yeah. It's all for a good cause though, isn't it? So what I'll do is, for everybody that's listening, I'll include a link to Dr. Lee's book, The Complete Book of Cat and Dog Health, in the show notes as well, if you're interested in purchasing that, which I definitely recommend. And I'll also pop links to your website as well. And we will include a link to the WSAVA guidelines on don't neuter your dog.
Yes.
Well, thanks again, Dr. Lise. We'll catch up soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another great episode of the My Dog Made Me Do It Naturally podcast. Don't forget to check out the caption for any links discussed here today. And please, if you enjoyed the show, follow along and listen for free on your favourite podcast app. If you have any questions or would like to share your story, feel free to email me at mydogmademedoitnaturally@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Purpose of this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be substituted as advice from a veterinarian or other professional. It does not form a client relationship with me, the host, or any guest speakers, and any information is not intended to and does not diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent disease. And my guests express our own views, thoughts, and opinions as individuals, and the podcast neither endorses or opposes the views, products, or services discussed here. If your pet is ill, always seek advice from your veterinarian. I am not a veterinarian, and I do not treat disease or offer medical advice.